Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world with the best in the business. Top of that list, as far as I'm concerned, is Claudia Rosette, our first guest. She is the journalist in residence at the moment at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. She is a columnist and author. She writes for Forbes.com and PJ Media. You can find her work sprinkled around all of the best outlets in the world, as a matter of fact. And she is, by my lights, and I think that of her colleagues in the journalistic trade as well, one of the world's great investigative reporters. And Claudia, you've spent a lot of time in your distinguished career in the Far East. You have, in particular, I know, been watching closely this horrific regime in North Korea. And it's much on our minds at the moment because it's more threatening perhaps than ever. What do you make of the current bellicosity of this young Kim Jong-un and his regime?
Well, two basic points here. Thank you for the kind introduction, Frank. One is that North Korea has correctly assessed that it can get away with it. And the second is that North Korea is pioneering for the rest of the world to see how much you can get away with, something that Iran is definitely watching and learning from, and other countries are as well. So we're having a very dangerous reset here.
Yeah, yes. Right. When you say get away with it, what is the it that you have in mind? Is it just the posturing and poking us in the eye, or is there something more serious at work here?
There's something more serious at work. Where the posturing alone would be very bad. You know, wars often begin with miscalculations, and to have a country threatening to land nuclear weapons on Washington and South Korea, that's really not good. And they become more specific. This is no longer what was already the very bad threats to drown South Korea in seas of fire. North Korea has now been threatening to attack U.S. bases and so forth.
And I think even today they're talking about attacking the continental United States as well. It's really ratcheted up.
You don't want it to be the case that it's considered no big deal for countries to make threats like that or treated. I don't know if it's considered, but it's that the response is as if, we'll move our fleet around, we'll maneuver to shoot down your missiles, but we won't actually do something that will stop you. Second, and the rest of the problem is, these are not entirely hollow threats. North Korea has been testing nuclear weapons. They're called devices in the stories, but I assume they're testing weapons, not toasters. And they have been testing and selling missiles for years. And actually they've been working on their nuclear program for years. This is a wide, deep set of weapons programs of a very alarming kind. Oh, and don't forget, they also North Korea has also been producing chemical and biological weapons, to the best of our assessment. So there are, there can be plenty of debate about how precise could they be, how powerful could they be, but they are developing these weapons.
And Claudia, let me ask you this. There's a report in your previous employer's paper, the Wall Street Journal, today about the playbook that the Obama administration has been following in an effort to sort of follow a measured escalation of capabilities of our own, projecting power into the Korean Peninsula and otherwise rattling the saber a little bit in response to these kinds of threats by the North Koreans. I wonder whether you would agree with me that one of the things that may have made all of this possible in the case of the North Koreans and necessary in the case of our own posture has been the president's very aggressive, if I can use that term, pursuit of this notion that he'll rid the world of nuclear weapons starting with ours, do you think that the diminishing of our nuclear deterrent in the eyes of the North Koreans, and for that matter, it seems in the eyes of the South Koreans, is contributing to this drama?
Of course, because the message that it sends is North Korea can reasonably assess that our nuclear weapons actually pose no threat because we effectively are broadcasting that we will not use them. You know, once you have a policy that says we're simply not going to do this, our drive is going to be to get rid of our nuclear weapons, you create an environment in which anybody who has them may be at a far greater advantage. And as basically, the only thing that gives you power with a nuclear weapon in any kind of negotiation, you know, the only thing short of actually using it is that it has to be credible that you might use it. And once that becomes not credible, then you might as well not have them.
And that credibility is only partly a function of your, you know, sort of posture in terms of rhetoric and policy. It's also an assessment, I think, and fear of the hollowing out, not just of our military in general, but in particular of our deterrent. Let me ask you, Claudia, because, again, our guest is Claudia Rosette, formerly for many years at The Wall Street Journal, now the journalist in residence at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and also a columnist with Forbes.com and PJMedia.com. You have spent a lot of time in and near communist China, reporting for many years the editorial page of the Asian Journal. Talk to me about what communist China is doing in all of this. Are they aiding and abetting the North Koreans? Are they dissuading them from taking these sorts of provocative steps, or some of both?
They're mostly aiding and abetting, at the very least, tolerating when they really need not. This has been a pattern for years at this point that North Korea has repeatedly not only made threats, but done things like, remember the attack on the South Korean frigate and islands a few years ago.
And murderous attack.
Yeah, exactly. This is often part of the negotiating pattern that North Korea engages in. It then uses these hostilities to wring concessions. But China, over and over, you will see stories when these things have happened, that China has now had enough, China is going to stop this. China has not stopped 3 nuclear tests, the development of ballistic missiles, the huge arms trade that goes on. And, you know, look at the geography. China basically controls North Korea's, apart from the DMZ, North Korea's major land border. And it's China's growing maritime presence that is right off North Korea's coast.
So, we've actually had reports, Claudia Rosette, of North Korean arms shipments flying over Chinese territory, landing, refueling, and going on. So you couldn't be more right that they're
Frank,
enabling this.
The North Korean who helped supply the Syrian reactor built with North Korean help, who was involved in the procurement for it, had an office in China. China has also been played the part of middleman in some of the transactions.
Certainly an enabler. Claudia, quickly, we have to turn to a related topic. North Korea's other main partner in much of this seems to be Iran at the moment. You've just written a very important piece about Iran's status at the United Nations as a powerhouse, not a pariah. Talk about that. And what possibly could be going on there?
Well, they have been investing a lot of effort, time, and at one point, our own ambassador, Susan Rice, mentioned that they had invested a lot of money. I asked what money and never got an answer, but they've been investing resources of substantial kinds.
They, the Iranians?
Iran's government, in influential positions at the UN. And at the moment, they chair through 2015, they chair the second largest voting bloc in the UN General Assembly, the Non-Aligned Movement. They sit on the boards of more than half a dozen major agencies, including UNICEF, the UN Development Program,
Unless we forget the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the other multilateral organization that is very much an influential factor in all of these UN things. Claudia, we're going to have to let you go, I'm afraid, but only with the promise that we will have you back to discuss this at greater length further, because this really is so critical to our understanding of the mischief that is being made, at very best mischief. At worst, it's downright malevolence of the United Nations these days. We're going to be talking with Ted Bromond in the next segment about some of how that mischief is translating perhaps into a threat to our first, or at least our Second Amendment freedoms. And Claudia, we thank you very much for joining us. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Ted Bromond, straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being from time to time, by Ted Bromond. Dr. Bromond is currently a senior research fellow in Anglo-American relations at the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom of the Heritage Foundation. He has just returned from the wars, truly the very front at the moment in the war for the free world at the United Nations, as we were just discussing with Claudia Rosette. Ted, you have been working, trying to work against, I guess it's fair to say, something called the Arms Trade Treaty. Tell us, if you would, what the Arms Trade Treaty is about. What does it purport to do?
Well, Frank, it purports to do something that the United States already does. It purports to require nations around the world to establish a system that will control their imports and exports of arms of all kinds. This is not just a treaty about small arms, as is sometimes mistakenly reported. It's a treaty about everything from revolvers all the way up to battleships. Every kind of conventional weapon, in other words, everything that's not a weapon of mass destruction. It doesn't cover nuclear weapons, for example. So the treaty, in theory, requires nations to do something that's fairly commonsensical, have some basic legal standards for when you sell or transfer weapons abroad, and have some sort of control system that allows you to regulate and prosecute people who export or import weapons illegally. Now, in theory, that sounds like good stuff.
Yes, all sounds innocuous, unobjectionable.
Yeah, it's always with the UN, the devil's in the details.
Well, to the extent that the devil's in this particular details are going to perhaps have real bearing on what will be our not only ability to protect ourselves and assist our allies in protecting themselves through the transfer of some of these conventional weapons, but also the extent to which they may bear upon our own rights here in the United States to bear arms. Ted, you were describing what both seemed unobjectionable about the treaty and some of the things that are almost certainly going to be very profound problems. How will this treaty, in fact, impinge upon our ability, say, to provide support to friendly nations whose security is very much in our interest, like, say, Israel?
Yeah, you're quite right to point to Israel. I would also add Taiwan as one of the nations that might be the most affected by this treaty. At the heart of the treaty is the idea that nations should only transfer arms if they will not be used to commit or facilitate, and facilitate is a very broad word, violations against international humanitarian law. We used to call those the laws of war, and international human rights law, a much vaguer concept. Now, in theory, the U.S. already has human rights standards on the transfer of weapons abroad. The problem with adopting these sorts of standards in treaty format is that the U.S. does not define either of these two terms on its own. The U.S. has basically signed up to a set of standards that can and will be reinterpreted by the so-called international community, by left-wing NGOs, by liberal lawyers, and held to change over time to disallow sales and transfers that we previously made, or retrospectively to criticize things that we've already done as violating our treaty commitments because they violate international humanitarian law. So what we've got here is an open-ended treaty. It's impossible to know what you're committing yourself to it, but by supporting it in the General Assembly, as we've done, we've signaled that it's at least sort of acceptable for us to adopt these non-standard standards, if you will.
Yeah, and that is a formula, as I say, for much mischief at the hands of those who seek through these kinds of treaties to interfere with our national security policymaking and practice. But Ted Brahman, talk a little bit about a concern that I know some in the gun rights community who are already feeling a bit besieged by various efforts the Obama administration is making through our own national legislative efforts and those of some of the states. Are we likely to see this arms trade treaty of the United Nations being used to impose restrictions on gun ownership by private American citizens as well?
Well, you know, I think it's a mistake to talk about this as a UN gun grab, if only because the UN, and I give thanks for this every day, is a tremendously incompetent organization. And that's one thing we really have going for us here. But that said, I do have some concerns in regards affairs inside the United States. One of the big, I would say even the overriding campaign among the left, is the idea that the U.S. Constitution needs to be reinterpreted according to standards of customary international law. Sometimes this is called
improved.
Improved, as they would see it, right. The First Amendment is too broad. The freedom of the press is too broad. There's too much freedom of religion. There's too much freedom of firearms ownership. The left is frequently fond of saying all of these things. So one of their strategies is to say international norms are evolving and the U.S. Constitution needs to be reinterpreted in light of those evolving norms. So you don't override the Constitution. You just change the meaning of the words on the page.
Yeah. As a practical matter, you amend it by de facto action rather than de jure.
Yeah, it's stealth amendment, essentially.
Now, let me ask you about this. And again, our guest is Ted Brahman of the Heritage Foundation. He is the author of numerous very important analyses of these sorts of matters, including several very, very important papers published by the Heritage Foundation on the Arms Trade Treaty. I commend them to you. You can find them at heritage.org. He is also the author of The Blair Legacy, Politics, Policy, Governance, and Foreign Affairs about former Prime Minister Tony Blair. Ted, talk, if you would, in the remaining couple of minutes we have, about where this whole can of worms now stands. The UN General Assembly having adopted it, why was that necessary? And are we going to be bound by this treaty unless and until the Senate ratifies it?
Well, the process has been very complicated. There was a negotiating conference at the United Nations in late March that failed to reach an agreement. So the treaty advocates simply jumped outside the conference, went to the General Assembly, and voted the treaty through on majority rule. That's an incredibly dangerous precedent. The next time we have a negotiating conference on, let's say, global warming or the use of armed unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, and the U.S. happens to be in the minority, we set the precedent that what you do then is jump to the General Assembly and vote it through in majority rule.
Yeah, that's a key point. We helped set this precedent.
It's an incredibly, incredibly damaging thing for us to have done. So right now, the treaty will be open for national signature on June 3rd. It remains uncertain whether President Obama will sign the treaty. My gut says he will, but probably not right away. I think he's likely to wait for some of the heat to die down a little bit on it. But in any case, if the president should sign it, it should then go to the Senate for advice to consent, commonly known as ratification. Unfortunately, once the president signs a treaty, the U.S. acquires certain legal obligations as a result of that signature. I wish I could be more precise, but those legal obligations are really very difficult to define. So my sense is that the Senate is unlikely in the foreseeable future to approve this treaty, but it could very easily be signed by the president in the not-too-distant future and give us a set of requirements that would ultimately be subject to the interpretation of Eric Holder's lawyers.
Yeah,
and I don't find that very appealing.
No, it's a staggeringly frightening prospect, but specifically because, and it's not just Eric Holder's lawyers, it's the State Department lawyers, in my experience, Ted Brahman, that always cite this treaty or convention, the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, I believe it's called. And while you're right, there's lots of different pieces to this. Essentially, reduced to its essence in layman's terms, as I understand it, it commits us not to undermine the object and purpose of the treaty, which has the practical effect, under these lawyers' interpretation at least, of binding us to the treaty, whether the Senate ratifies it or not. Is that not correct?
That's essentially correct, Frank. It's very difficult to know how different administrations will interpret this object and purpose requirement. If this were President Reagan's administration or President George W. Bush's administration, I probably wouldn't be quite so concerned about that. Different administrations can take, to a certain extent, legitimately different positions about what their view of this requirement is. And an administration that wants to use this treaty for purposes that I think you and I would probably find unappealing and unattractive, even dangerous, is going to have a fair amount of freedom once the treaty
indeed.
Is signed to do just that.
Ted Brahman, we have to let you go at that. Come back to us soon with an update, if you would. Next up, we've got Fred Flights joining us to give us a sense of what is going on with this North Korean bit straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Songer.
I had a feeling about this. Uh-huh. I'm rich. Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit card.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The hype behind so-called comprehensive immigration reform continues to mount. Much of it is fueled by speculation about what 8 senators, 4 Democrats and 4 Republicans, are cooking up behind closed doors. A chilling insight was afforded over the weekend, however, by one of those Democratic senators, Chuck Schumer of New York. He declared that the group's priority would be legalization first, border security second. In other words, the millions of aliens already unlawfully here would be put on the, quote, path to citizenship, unquote, immediately, and long before the path for more to come to America illegally is shut down. Given this prospect, there has reportedly been of late a 500% increase in unlawful border crossings. We must have secure borders before more incentives are offered to come to this country. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion, realize Shaq's mechanism. Yah, 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 yah. Yah, yah, yah.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rap. This is not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're going to go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back, joined as we have the very high honor of being each week by Fred Flights of the Langley Intelligence Group Network.com, also known as Lignet.com. Fred is a career intelligence professional with a lot of time in service at the Central Intelligence Agency going back to the Reagan administration. He also served in senior positions in the State Department and on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, a man who knows his way around the world of intelligence. And Fred, it's always good to have you with us to share a bit of that insight. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
You have been writing at Lignet.com, Fred, which again is a terrific resource, folks, and I commend it to you as a go-to place for a lot of information on these issues of importance to us, about the nature of and the future course, perhaps, of the North Korean drama at the moment. We spoke about it earlier in the program with Claudia Rosette, but I'd like to get your take on it. Particularly because you had a featured interview with former CIA Director General Michael Hayden, in which he said something sort of curious to me, Fred. He said, on the one hand, this is an extremely dangerous situation, and yet he rated the possibility of it having a nuclear component to it as extremely low. What do you make of that? And more generally, where are we, do you think, with respect to the North Korean threat?
Well, I'd like to start with General Hayden. We had an excellent interview with the former CIA director who was on our advisory board. He said that the situation with North Korea is on the edge, and they're running out of threats that they can throw forward. He's worried about a miscalculation that could occur that could result in some type of attack. However, he does not think that the North Koreans will engage in a nuclear attack. His belief seems to be that they would fear that would risk a career-ending counterattack from the United States. So his view is that they won't do that.
Yeah, it's career-ending, life-ending, regime-ending, country-ending, perhaps, attack, if in fact we have the capacity still to and the will to wage a nuclear retaliation against them for such an action.
Well, one thing that we talked about on the site today, and it repeats something that we talked about last week, is has the U.S. played this right? And our view right now is echoed by an article on the Wall Street Journal this week that the Obama administration has come to the conclusion that they probably miscalculated with their displays of military might, thinking that this would force the North Koreans to back down. It has instead provoked them to become more radical and to issue more threats. And we may have actually forced them to exhaust the kinds of threats they can throw out faster, creating a situation where North Korean leader Kim Jong-un may feel he's cornered now and may feel he's forced to engage in some type of terrorist attack or small-scale military attack. So for this reason, according to the Journal, and we strongly agree with this, the U.S. may have miscalculated, and the Obama administration is backing away from the military displays.
Yeah. Fred, let me ask you this, because I talked a little bit about it with Claudia, too, but I have a theory of what's happened here that I'd like to get your sense of. And again, our guest is Fred Flights of Langley Intelligence Group Network. The president's miscalculation, it seems to me, occurred long before the adoption and then the implementation of this playbook, as it's being described in the Wall Street Journal today. Namely, the actions that he has taken over his entire presidency to badmouth, to run down, and otherwise diminish our nuclear deterrent posture. As you know so well, because proliferation is one of your main professional interests, he has made it a project of his administration to eliminate nuclear weapons all over the world, starting with ours, unfortunately. Do you think, Fred, as you look at this North Korean crisis, that it may have, in some measure at least, been inspired by the North Korean regime's perceptions of our weakness and particularly a diminishing of our nuclear deterrent posture?
Absolutely. And what we've seen from the beginning of this administration has been an effort to basically move against nuclear weapons, against aggressive policy, and to stress negotiations. And this has communicated a message of weakness to our adversaries around the world. What we've been seeing over the last few weeks is a mad scramble to reestablish some type of military deterrent. And we've seen that with the missiles being rushed out to Guam. We've seen that with the stealth planes being flown. This is a mistake of their own making. They grossly underestimated the mindset of these dictators, and now we're paying the price.
Yeah, and the trouble is, as I indicated to Claudia, I'm afraid that it is probably not only in the minds of Kim Jong-un and his cohort that this calculation of American weakness or irresolution has taken hold. And Fred, as you look around the world, and you do, of course, every day at Lignet.com, you see, I'm sure, evidence of similar kind of emboldening taking place. And great grief can flow from it. One of the places where I wondered if you might just drill down for a moment before we leave North Korea, Fred, though, is the nuclear plant that the North Korean regime has threatened to restart. Is that a real threat in your estimation? Could they at this point do so? And if they did, what might the implications be?
Well, they shut down the Yongdong 5-megawatt nuclear plant in 2007 in response to concessions by the Bush administration, and they then blew up the Kolin Tower the following year in response to more concessions. it will take years before this plant is up and running, and they probably couldn't produce plutonium for bombs from it. Maybe 3 years, maybe as long as five. Long before then, the United States and its Asian allies will offer concessions to stop this, and the North Koreans know that. This is not a serious gesture to restart the nuclear program.
Okay, so that's not a threat. But let's turn to Iran, a country that, as you know, Fred, has been very, very actively involved with the nuclear program. I think, in fact, last week you talked with us about how North Korean experts have been in Iran and vice versa, helping each other with their not only nuclear program but missile program. One of the things that you feature on your site today, fredflights@lignet.com, is an Iranian warship of apparently some capability being introduced in the Caspian Sea. Is that principally a regional game changer in terms of the correlation of forces, if you will, perhaps with implications for oil in that region, or is it something bigger?
There are huge oil and gas reserves in the Caspian Sea, and Iran has very questionable international legal claims to them under borders. And they're trying to build a navy in the Caspian to intimidate Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan to basically seize these reserves, and which they're mostly already doing. Now, they built a ship, which they call a destroyer, but it's probably a large frigate, Jamaran 2. This shows their indigenous capability to build a warship. Now, in the Caspian, you can't buy a warship from some other country unless Russia sold it to them. So the Iranians had to build it themselves. However, this is the second ship of this kind. They also built the Jamaran 1 a few years ago, which is on patrol in the Persian Gulf. It's simply showing how the Iranian military, the Iranian Navy, is slowly increasing its capabilities. It's a threat to the Caspian. It's a small threat, but it simply shows Iran's hostile intent.
Well, a small ship or a small threat can be a big problem in that small body of water. And as you say, it is rich with resources that the world increasingly demands. Fred, we've only got a minute left. Just very quickly, China, how is it perceiving the Obama administration in all of this? And is it being of any help to us at all on the North Korean problem?
I think the Obama administration is working with China right now to try to find a face-saving way out of the conflict so the Kim Jong-un government can back away. I think the Chinese are pretty upset with us for the way we've handled the North Korean situation. And John Kerry will be in the region next week, and I have a feeling that he's going to get some strong words from Chinese officials on basically everyone has to basically calm things down and let the North Koreans cool off.
Well, cool off and probably, if past practice is any guide, Fred, be rewarded for their aggressive behavior. Face-saving is one thing. I think if the practical effect of all of this, and you certainly know this very well from your study of it over the years at the CIA and up on Capitol Hill and at the State Department, is to make them even more brazen and aggressive in the future, we will all come to rue the day. Fred, we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us as always. Next up, Stephen Hayward talks to us about the end game on climate change and what that might mean for all of us. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened, period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show.
Up in the morning and out to school.
Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Stephen Hayward. He is the author of numerous, I mean, almost more than I can count, important books, many of them dedicated to helping us understand our leadership, past, present, and perhaps future. The newest book is Politically Incorrect Guide to the Presidents, From Wilson to Obama. And heavens knows there's a lot of politically incorrect things that need to be said about President Obama, and we'll get into some of that in a moment. But Stephen Hayward is currently a fellow at the Claremont Institute and the Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Ashbrook Center. He has in the past held a number of positions in other estimable organizations, including one of my personal favorites, the Heritage Foundation, where he has served as a Bradley Fellow and a Henry Salvatore Fellow. Stephen Hayward, you bring to this present topic, in other words, an historian's perspective, the view of the long haul, and that certainly seems appropriate at a moment when we've been told that the sky is falling imminently. Tell us a little bit about your concerns about this whole theory of man-caused global climate change and how the evidence has begun to debunk it.
Right. Well, this has been sort of the latest and greatest hits in a long line of apocalyptic scares from the environmental movement that go back at least to the population bomb of the late 1960s, right? And in every single case that you can look at for the last 40 years, the problems that we're told are going to bring the end of the world were in every case overestimated, sometimes vastly overestimated, not entirely wrong, but way over. And then the second problem was the solution is always dreadful, even worse than the problem. And the solution is always more political power centralized with bureaucrats in Washington or even on a global scale, right? I mean, right. The ultimate wish list is for a UN global environment agency to control resource and energy and so forth. So when climate change came along, you know, 25 years ago, it kind of burst on the scene. My default suspicion was this is going to be another one of these cases where you know, it turns out to be overestimated or perhaps, you know, even completely phony. And so I've been following it for quite a long time and gotten way off into the weeds, and there's an awful lot to it. But the point is a few 2 years ago, you started to see in the mainstream science, quote unquote, a lot of scientists saying, you know, these climate models predicting, you know, that we're all going to fry are probably wrong, probably vastly overestimating what's known as climate sensitivity.
Now, let me ask you about this, Steve, if I may, because sure. What we have been told almost every time that this issue is brought up in polite company is there's actually no dissent on this question. Every scientist worth their salt knows that the climate is heating up, that man is causing it. There are some, you know, outliers, but they certainly don't really reflect the consensus view across the broad scientific spectrum. Not so?
No, that's the great lie of the sort of politicization of this issue.
The big lie, in other words, because it really has been propounded like the big lie endlessly so.
Yeah, I mean, what you'll find is that even the people who are among the so-called skeptics community will say that greenhouse gases do increase the temperature by a modest amount. And what the alarmists say is, no, it's going to be the end of the world. It's going to be 5, 6, 7 degrees or something like that. And the evidence for the extreme temperature projections is just very weak. And increasingly, we're seeing that the models turn out to be wrong. I mean, what happened was, is we had two decades in the 80s and 90s, when temperatures actually did rise quite sharply. And then it stopped, see, and here's the problem. We've had no temperature increase for the last 15, 16 years now. And so all the models are now wrong because all the models say we should be steadily increasing in temperature, and that stopped happening. So when the models are wrong, guess what? The whole case starts to fall apart.
Yeah. And again, the point here is sort of, if I understand, and this is very much a layman's view, Stephen Hayward, is that we have a question of whether the planet is actually warming. And secondly, if it is actually warming, and is it because of what we've been doing in terms of pumping out, you know, the various carbon created products? Break those down, if you would. Is it actually at the moment, in your judgment, and on the basis of the scientific evidence, still warming? And secondly, if it is, are we causing it?
Yeah, well, you know, we really only have about 35 years of halfway decent data to say that the planet is warming or not. I mean, it's when we launched satellites in the late 70s that take some really comprehensive measurements. Before that, we have to go on a mix of records that you know, are really kind of thin. I mean, how do you tell what the average temperature of the whole planet is? That's not a simple question. And if you try and project back, it gets even more dicey because we're looking at things like tree rings and all kinds of crazy things.
Core samples taken out of the Arctic and Antarctic and all that sort of thing. Right.
Things of that kind, exactly. And some of the science is very clever on this, and you know, I kind of admire it. On the other hand, we have very low confidence that we really understand the climate history going back even 300 or 400 years, let alone 4,000 or 10,000 years. We come out of an ice age here about 10,000 years ago and then the so-called little ice age of about 200 years ago. So it's not at all out of the question that the fluctuations we've seen are entirely the result of natural cycles.
Mm-hmm. And those could be everything from solar flaring to the warming of the oceans for other reasons. But do we actually have a basis for saying that if we stopped using the internal combustion engine, for example, kind of with catastrophic effects, needless to say, for many of us, that would make any material difference in these trends?
No, it probably wouldn't make any difference at all. I mean, if you have a lot of natural forces, you mentioned a couple, you know, changing solar radiation, trends in ocean temperatures and currents that we don't understand very well. If those are actually driving what's going on, then the disappearance of humanity itself would make no difference to the temperature trends.
There are bigger schemes at work here than us. Let me just read something, because it seems so prescient based on what you've just told us. And again, our guest is Stephen Hayward. He is the Claremont Fellow and Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Ashbrook Center, and author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Presidents, From Wilson to Obama. But you said this in a cover story at the Weekly Standard 3 years ago, I believe, quote, "Eventually, the climate modeling community is going to have to reconsider the central question. Have the models that the UN's group on climate change used for its predictions of catastrophic warming overestimated the climate sensitivity to greenhouse gases," unquote. And you basically say in your piece at Powerline recently, March 29th, that even The Economist, which is apparently privately admitted to you that it has been cheerleading on this editorial direction, it now acknowledges that you got that about right and that the scientists at the UN have gotten it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I've followed The Economist for years, and you know, some of their news coverage is pretty good, but it's been dreadful on this subject. And so this is a very major break from a major media outlet. But beyond all that, the UN group, it's called the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Right.
They're the ones who put out these huge reports every 5-6 years. Another one is due in a few months, and there have been some early leaks that suggest that even the UN body, which is deeply committed to the environmental agenda, is going to acknowledge that their models have been wrong, that there's more that we don't understand about this than that we do understand about it. And so this could represent really the beginning of the end, I think, of even the official UN action on this.
Let me ask you, Stephen Hayward, you mentioned the environmental agenda of the United Nations. This is, of course, wrapped up in a political agenda, which you alluded to a moment ago. Speak to that, if you would. And then also, and because we're almost out of time, just very quickly, what do you make of the commander-in-chief of the U.S. forces in the Pacific saying the biggest threat he faces is climate change?
Yeah, that was Admiral Locklear. I thought at first that has to be Heather Locklear, some Hollywood actress, right? It can't be an admiral.
Or an April Fool's joke or something.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think
especially
really
with North
shows...
Korea. We've been talking about North Korea throughout the program. Give me a break.
I mean, you're close to these issues than I am, and it's another bad sign to me of how the military has become politicized, and that's a very bad. So that's a crazy thing to say. Even by the way, if you believe in catastrophic climate change, that's a crazy thing to say,
right?
Because the effects are entirely unpredictable, out several decades. So that was just nutty. The bigger problem here that's driving all this is that environmentalists, from the beginning 40 years ago, have wanted to get control of energy and especially fossil fuels. And climate change seemed like the perfect excuse to do that. Really what drives all this politically is a hatred of fossil fuels and a hatred of actually human energy use. If the climate crusade begins to unravel, they're going to have to find something else to continue their drive.
I'm sure there will be some new gambit that will be trotted out. The climate is now screeching to a much, much colder temperature, which actually I think we would all agree, Stephen Hayward, would be a much bigger problem than if it gets a bit warmer. We thank you very much for your insights in all of this, Stephen. It's really important work. Check it out at Powerline and also, of course, at the superb Claremont Institute. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon, sir. Keep up the good work in the meantime. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you again. I hope tomorrow.
Great, thanks,
same
Frank.
Time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks so much for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.